Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Technology is usually so indoors, but remember, it's summer, and that's when we try to go outdoors. These days, the two concepts are not mutually exclusive, and we're not talking about the iPod and some earbuds. The tech frontier has expanded to the outdoors in many ways to make your rugged adventures safer and more comfortable. Joining us to talk more about the latest in outdoor gadgetry is Alice Truong, gadgets columnist for USA Today and reviews editor for Device. Alice, welcome to the All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with Garmin's Fenix. It's an all-in-one watch with what? I mean, everything.
Yeah, basically. So on your wrist, you have essentially a very advanced computer. It's a compass, it's an altimeter, it's a barometer, it's a GPS, of course. It also tells you the weather, and it has a lot of capabilities that will designed to help you, like, you know, navigate and guide your way back to your camp without getting lost.
It seems like a lot to pack into a package that we describe as a watch, although those come in all sizes, granted. Do you need tiny fingers to work this thing? How does it work?
Actually, tiny fingers I don't think are necessary. There are only five buttons on here, and it's got a large watch face, so you might find that it's actually suited for people with larger wrists. And the buttons, for the most part, are pretty easy to navigate. There's one giant red button that's supposed to help you find, like, navigate through the menus. There's an up and down, a back, and a light button. So for the most part, you can find what you're looking for pretty easily. But there is a lot to look through.
How does it keep track of you on the trail?
So what you do is you leave kind of a trail of digital breadcrumbs. So along the way, you can start your GPS to track your route, and all this time it logs your elevation, your time, and when you add a waypoint, which can be anything like a trailhead or a campsite, you can see on the display where you are relative to it. It's a sophisticated GPS inside a very, very small computer that's worn on your on your wrist.
So if you get lost, it just takes you backwards.
If you get lost, it'll show you where you are relative to your route. And there's a specific feature called Track Back that is supposed to help you shepherd your way along this recorded route that you started.
For the avid hikers out there who want to track their journeys, it can provide quite a bit of data for them to analyze.
It's true. And you can also upload all of this information as well to the web. And some people like to, especially if they're bushwhackers, or they like going off the trail, people like to look at what others have gone and done, and they might follow it as well.
And, all right, this is always the wrap-up call. How much does it cost, and what do you get with the Performer Bundle?
Okay, so it costs $400, and I'm trying to think of what the Performer Bundle is. I think it's an additional $50 for a heart rate monitor, as well as a little
device. I need a heart rate monitor right now. Okay, go on.
As well as a little device that you can attach to your shoe, so it also takes, like, records analytics from your foot movement as well.
So this is for the hiker who has everything.
Yeah, and a budget.
Right. Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday. We're talking about tech gear for camping. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You also wrote about the Runtastic GPS watch.
Yeah. So, you know, off the bat, this is a $150 watch, so it's not quite comparable to the Fenix watch from Garmin. But it's an interesting example of, you know, a tech startup that's been app-based moving into the hardware space. So there are a lot of, you know, similar capabilities, just not as robust. It comes with a heart strap, a heart rate strap as well, and there's a navigational mode that can save routes and waypoints, but just not as many. So whereas the Garmin watch could record 1,000 tracks, the Runtastic watch could record 10 tracks.
It has several modes. Tell us about the GPS workout mode versus the GPS navigation mode. What's the difference?
Okay, so in GPS workout mode, the Runtastic watch will track your speed, your distance, your training time, and your heart rate, given that you're using the strap. This is something separate, an external thing that you're strapping to your chest, so some people might choose not to use it. And in navigation mode, it saves these routes, of the 10 routes and up to 99 waypoints along a path.
All right. Okay. So that's what it is. How does it work with desktop software?
So both with both these types of watches, they have a USB cable that charges these watches up and also allows you to connect to the web, and you can upload your information to the web. So, you know, it's more, we're in a more connected world these days, and everybody wants to keep track of everything and share with everybody. So these watches have that capability.
Do they have any capabilities about keeping you with, there might be different people in your group walking farther ahead or farther behind. Is there any connection there?
No, unfortunately not. But that's an interesting idea because, you know, sometimes there are stragglers in a group and you don't want to lose them.
Yeah. Oh, if you knew how many great ideas I have, Alice Trung, you'd be amazed.
You just need to come up to San Francisco and just pitch a VC, and then you get your funding, and then you just go on to your next big thing.
Well, let's hear from Alex. He emailed us a suggestion for camping. He says lanterns are also good to have on hand at home for blackouts. There are new and in our neck of the country, we have a lot of blackouts. There are new types of lanterns with LED lights that are far better than the old types, using less power and lasting much longer on a set of batteries. And some are hand cranked, so you can keep them charged beyond the life of batteries. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's
important. REI's Flex Light Chair. This isn't high tech per se, but I'm intrigued by it. Tell us about it.
Okay, so this is actually one of my new favorite, like, lo-fi gadgets. There's no, like, there's nothing you charge up or plug in. It's just a chair. But it's essentially made of tent materials, like aluminum poles that basically snap themselves together, and a ripstop nylon, so it's very similar to the exterior of your tent. And you construct it in a minute or two. You break it down in, you know, as much time. But it can support 250 pounds, and I like to just basically throw two of these in a bag and just go out to a park or wherever of the day, because they break down super small, about 14 inches by 4, and they only weigh a pound each. So instead of lugging around those giant beach chairs you might have that weigh like 14 pounds, this is a much, much better alternative.
But do they have a beverage holder?
No, there is no beverage holder. So if you're willing to sacrifice the beverage holder, you've got a fine chair.
Okay. And something so light, I was really surprised it held 250 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many advances in the outdoor gear space. Materials are so light and so strong. It's amazing what we can do these days.
But you cannot use it on a beach. And why is that?
So it's because it's uneven. The ground, you know, you might just sink into it. Sand might get caught in the joints. You'll find the same thing with, even if you're not on sand, just like camping on in a particularly hilly part. It just you're leaning yourself forward and get a little awkward. So there are limitations.
Now, the Lopros Photo Sport Pro Backpack, long name for a backpack that is great for people who want to bring their technology, especially their camera, with them.
Yeah. Lopro has a number of bags that are designed to bring everything when you're going camping, which can be kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But, you know, for those who like to lug their gear, and I myself am prone to doing this as well. You can, you know, drag your telephoto lens, your several, your large SLR, flash, other accessories, and then this is just all for your camera stuff. There's a separate compartment that you can remove and put back into the bag. And then, of course, you have to bring everything else that you need, right? Everything from water to your hiking poles, your tent, et cetera.
Yeah, my backpacking experiences go way, 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 way back, and I can't believe how the backpacks have changed and improved.
Yeah, definitely. Just the other day, I was checking out this new bag that's designed for kids, and you know you don't want to buy a new bag for your son if he's growing like every other week basically. Mm-hmm. And there's a bag made by Gregory Packs, and these are just lightweight packs that are supposed to grow with your kid. So it's adjustable straps around the waist and also around the back so that you can raise and lower the bag as your child is growing.
As far as that, the attachable or detachable bag for the camera, is that as high a quality? Is that the sort of thing that you could carry around anyway or not necessarily?
Yeah, you definitely can.
Okay.
It's a good sturdy bag, and it's got many pockets and compartments inside just for holding your accessories as well. And dividers too, so that your gear doesn't, like, you know, crash against each other while you're hiking. But you probably wouldn't, just because, you know, it's one of those bags that it only has two handles and you're just carrying around. Okay. Plus, LowPro, you know, being outdoor photo bags, being their bread and butter, they have a very excessive line of different bags for, like, you know, day packs, or just, like, for a quick hike. They have something for everyone's needs, essentially.
I love the name, Smith & Wesson Tactical Fire Striker Pen. If the ammo has run out at your local gun store, you can always get a Smith & Wesson Tactical Fire Striker Pen. Tell us about that, Alice Trong.
It's definitely one of the more interesting things I've come across. So this is a $40 pen, and essentially, if you unscrew the two parts, you'll find a fire striker. So if you're in a bind and this is what you need to get your fire started, you can, you know, unscrew the two parts and then rub the top of the pen against the groove of another part of the pen, and that can yield sparks. What's also very interesting, this is a really heavy pen as well. It's 6 inches long and it's about 2 ounces. So, you know, as a tactical pen, you can also use this to, I don't know, protect yourself in the woods.
I was thinking about the fire, you know, lighting part of it last night, and thinking, you know, that was sort of one of the original technologies. That's one of the things that started to set us apart.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think cavemen had this tactical fire striker pen.
No. This is 21st century all the way. Helio pressure shower. You know, showers are getting to be a big deal out there. The next camper we get must have a shower. But this isn't exactly super luxury.
No, it's not. It's something that perhaps backpackers might scoff at, just because it's another necessary thing to drag along on your trip. But it's essentially a shower that you don't need to hang. So it's not a gravity shower. Like, you don't have to hang it on a tree branch. And you just leave it on the ground, and once you fill it up, it's got an 11-liter tank that's collapsible, so you're not dragging an 11-liter tank out. You can use a foot pump, and that pressurizes this tank, and the water comes through a hose. And it's sort of like one of those, you know, the hose you have in your kitchen for washing dishes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not luxury, but it takes away some of the pains that are associated with bringing a shower along to the outdoors.
And real quick, we've talked about the BioLite camp stove before, but let's bring it up again in this context. It eats just 1.6 ounces of twigs, pine cones, and leaves. I'm telling you, to boil a liter of water, I don't get it. 1.6 ounces of twigs, pine cones, that's nothing. How does it work?
So the BioLite camp stove, again, one of those outdoor tools that backpackers might scoff at because it's a lot of unnecessary weight, is a stove that has a USB port. And so when you put in your biomass, your twigs, your pine cones, and your leaves, the heat from that will power that USB port and also a fan to improve combustion. So that's how you work this thing. You can, you know, cook yourself dinner and charge up your iPhone. But again, you're in the outdoors, so you don't really need your iPhone.
So, all right, we have an email from Becky. This was inevitable, Alice. She writes, is it really smart to become dependent upon all this high-tech camping gear? I know people who can't drive anywhere without GPS because they learn to rely on being fed directions. What happens when you're out in the woods and technology fails? And she's right.
Yeah. There's a really good point to be said of this. But if you look at, if you even just go to like an REI store these days, you know, there's the high-tech stuff that is geared towards your portable devices, right? The stuff that requires power. And then there's just the well-built things that are just useful to have around. And, you know, they're designed to be lighter and they're designed to be stronger. So they're designed to facilitate a more comfortable, if you will, backpacking trip. But yeah, I mean, if you're using a GPS all the time and you can't navigate around, like, there, you should take a step back and look at the problem. Perhaps, you know, familiarize yourself with the terrain, learn about it before you just go off unguided. Because technology does fail, and I encounter this all the time in my job reviewing gadgets. You know, as great as some things are, you know, things inevitably always fail.
But you know, one of the things I could get used to with the BioLite camp stove is that you can attach a grill to it now.
Yeah, you can. Again, great for car camping. You can buy a $60 attachment to the stove, and you can grill yourself perhaps like a burger. I never actually got a chance to try the grill itself, but it's still pretty small.
Well, Alice Truong, I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope you have a great summer camping.
Thanks. You too. You have a trip coming up, right?
Yes, I do. We're looking forward to it. Going to go away for 4 days. So Alice Truong, she's gadgets columnist for USA Today and reviews editor for Device. Coming up, more children's apps. There are so many out there. We're going to help you try to pick from them the best for your child. We'll be right back on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
Cracking passwords and getting around firewalls, it can be a thrill, but there comes a time when even a hacker has to choose.
You've got two ways you can go. You can go work for the good guys, good pay, travel to interesting countries, never have to look over your shoulder.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, hacking for good or evil, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. A basic membership for 89.7 NPR News starts at just $60 and comes with our airfare program guide and a grocery tote. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Family vacations are all well and good, but keeping the kids happy and productive in the back seat without snapping at each other is the trick. In fact, sometimes I think about the trips we took when I was a kid with five kids in our family and one car, and sometimes they just have to say, everybody shut up, and we had to shut up until we were told we could talk again. Joining us now to review some of the latest apps for kids is Warren Buchleitner. He's editor and founder of Children's Technology Review. Welcome to the show, Warren.
Hi, Ann. It's good to be with you.
So let's start with the youngest tablet users out there. For preschoolers, you've recommended The Jungle Book. So this is this an app or is it actually the story?
It's an app. It's sort of an app story. So it combines the Rudyard Kipling classic, really an adaptation. It uses these really fun 3D pages, and there's a lot to explore. It's really a fail-safe app. I know it costs $5, but this one's worth it.
It cracks me up. This is expensive. And I went and thought, well, gosh, how expensive is it? It's $4.99. I mean,
yeah,
it's cheaper than you're going to pay for a book.
Well, one of the messages is that we want to get out there is that some of these apps are worth the money if they don't have the in-app sales or gimmicks. And this doesn't. And, you know, we know that publishers need to make a living. And $5, if it's worth the play value, is okay.
It's by Story Toys, and you say that Story Toys apps take the page transitions a step further with a 3D effect. Tell me, describe the 3D effect if you can. I'm not quite sure I get that.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's like a pop-up book, really. When you lay your device, in this case an iPad, out, it's like the pages open up and unfold, and so you actually play in 3D. It's kind of the metaphor is like if you put your iPad on a turntable and you turn it, because the accelerometers are working with the graphics, it has that added effect. So it's pretty cool.
We're talking about apps for children. If you have a question, want to get some advice from our guest, Warren Buchleitner. He's editor and founder of Children's Technology Review. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Moving up the line to kindergartners,
yeah.
Grandma's Kitchen by Fair Lady Media. It's 99 cents, so it's in the realm of the usual. Tell us about that.
It's another fresh app. I think it's seven solid games. They're a school readiness, but they're fun, and there's a zany grandma character. One of the things I liked about it is that you can customize it for your child so that if you don't want you want the three reading-related games, you can turn those on and toggle the other ones off so that you have this added layer of control. It's a really nice nice app for 99 cents, and you'll get your money's worth out of that one.
It's got things like those puzzles that I still like to do, spot the difference.
Yeah.
In the food.
Yeah, and, you know, these are all really good. You know, you don't want to say the word workbook to any child who's alive. but this is has a lot of repetitive kinds of skill-building activities that are fun and in the context of the kitchen. So I used to be a teacher, so, you know, it doesn't hurt.
When you talk about this is 7 school readiness games, that's a good deal for 99 cents?
Yeah, that's for that one. Yeah, absolutely.
And when you use the phrase fresh app, what do you mean? It's just new?
Yeah, it's
okay.
New. It's out within the last month.
You know, the reason why we do this segment is the number of apps is getting overwhelming. And when you're a parent trying to figure out what to let your child look at, we need some guidance. But with children's apps, it's particularly bad. I mean, it's hard to know what, as you referred to earlier, is a gimmick or something genuine.
Right. That's why we're doing our job, Ann, aren't we? We're, you know... That's what we do is we try to look at all these apps and figure out which ones work.
For ages 4 to 7, which could include kindergartners, Toca Builders by Toca Boca. It's block play.
Yeah. This is a really interesting app, and block play on a 2-dimensional screen has been tried many times before. Anyone has heard of Minecraft knows that. You know, it's really amazing to be able to build these virtual worlds and so on. And Toca Builders does that on the iPad very nicely. And I was really excited to see this app. It's again, this one's also 99 cents. And you know, there's a lot of open-ended play with that. It's the kind of thing that a child can, you know, you really don't know what they're going to make.
They're actually manipulating 6 machines.
Yeah, it's interesting. It teaches them controls that they, let's say you're going to be operating a backhoe someday. You never know, you know.
You don't.
I hope I am. But, you know, there are a lot of sort of mechanics that machines use that are great. And that's what this, kids walk away from the experience with that.
When you're judging these apps and these games, how much goes into it that it's something you'd like to do?
A lot. I'm always thinking about play patterns. So, you know, at the end of the day, if a child doesn't like it or, you know, they're going to hit the home button and go to something they do like,
mm-hmm.
hopefully they'll also learn something. And, you know, some of these are great social experiences as well.
It's fun to do them together.
Yep.
For ages 5 to 11, I have a description here, so it's great for long car trips with multiple players.
Yeah.
Sounds like something we could have used when I was a kid. It's called Match Blitz. It's free. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's from Australia. I wanted to just put in a couple for the long car trips. I've been on many myself, both as a child with 3 older brothers, you know, and you can get killed back there.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous. And both, and also with my 2 daughters driving through Ohio many times. So these 2 games are social. So we call them huddle games. So a group of kids can play them together. Match Blitz is free. And basically we each get up to 4 players gets a corner of the iPad, and you got to see objects that appear on the other. It's kind of like a card game, as fast as possible. And the better you do, the harder the challenge. So it's really, really good for a collaborative experience.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about children's apps right now. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Warren Buchleitner, he's editor and founder of Children's Technology Review. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why does this particular one work well for long car trips? Do the games last a long time? Are there just a lot of different variations on the theme?
No, it's more that it's something for 2 kids to do, 2 or 3 or 4 kids, or a parent, the parent who's not driving, and the child. you know, we want the technology to facilitate collaborative play. Sorry for the edu speak.
That's okay.
But I am an educator. And, you know, rather than isolate. And so I just want to emphasize one other point is to use the camera and let the child, even very young children at 2.5 and 3, can snap pictures of the things that they see that are important to them. And, you know, it's a great way for them to replay and their trip. So, you know, we got to think outside the box, use these devices to facilitate the kind of learning that we want our kids to have.
That's a great idea, though. Just give your kid the camera and let him shoot.
Yep. It's very empowering for them, and that's one of the reasons we invest in this technology.
Max's Pirate Planet. It's a board game adventure. It's a little pricey, $2.99 by Slant Six Games. What's that like?
It's a well-designed multiplayer game. This would be for older kids. Match Blitz, the first one, would be for younger.
Okay.
More broad age range, and that one's free, so you can't go wrong. But mm-hmm. Max's Pirate Planet is for ages 7 and up. It has more strategy. It's kind of like you want to think out your moves before you take them. The board is the board instead of a flat board game. It's like a globe. It's really an interesting game, and there's also a lot of arcade style games where you get to shoot cannons at each other and that kind of thing. So that one's lots of fun.
I would imagine a lot of these apps take color and so forth to another place.
The Apple calls it a retinal display screen, and it really has meant a lot for children's publishing. A children's author can take beautiful images to the screen, really do some delightful things with it.
Does it matter? I mean, does that color matter to children, or is it the game? Do you know as an educator what's more important?
It varies. There's so many different kinds of apps. I've seen apps that are totally black and white, and it's really sort of retro. And then, you know, they do the Wizard of Oz effect where something color happens. There's a lot of creative work going on the multi-touch screens, and it's fun to see. And I think children's publishers have new tools that they haven't had before.
You said, as far as Max's Pirate Planet goes, you said it's a pass and play board game for up to 4 players. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's the way it works is you take your turn and then you pass the device to the next person. And if you don't, it's for 4 players. If you only have 2 players, that the computer takes over the other 2. So that's a little bit more of a limitation. I like games that are more active, but going back and forth, a lot of people only have 1 iPad. And so it makes sense to have a couple activities like that.
Is it the sort of game where you could have 2 iPads going and both be playing it at the same time?
Not this one.
Okay.
Not this one. This one is a single device.
Okay, so for a little more challenge for, I guess, the older kids, you mentioned Factory Balls by Bart Bonte?
Yeah, and I don't even know who that is, but he must be famous because he's... you know, they made a big deal about that. This is one of these games that just really makes your brain ache after you've played it for a while, or smoke starts coming out of your ears. and it's always good to have, you know, games like that where there's a challenge. And, you know, one of the things that kills you the most on a long trip is boredom. And so I guarantee that by the time you get to level 44 on this game, you'll really be... doing logical thinking in new ways. So it's what it is it shows you like a beach ball kind of model, and you have to replicate it by layering different layers of paint over it, and that requires all this planning. So it's really hard to describe it. Why are we doing this on a radio show? I need to show you this one.
Yeah, I know it's rough, but you know, I'm trying to make you use your radio skills now. We all should need to do that. But it's best for older children and adults. It's a leveled challenging game, so you achieve one level to move on to the next?
It's kind of like Angry Birds. Once you've done the one, it's called, B.F. Skinner used to call it mastery learning. And it's great. It really works. You know, it's like climbing a ladder, and the more you play, the harder it gets.
This month, you told us, has been busy with another excellent batch of apps, plus some prime examples of CD publisher behavior. And you mentioned See What Not to Do in Plato Create ABCs. It's a 2-star app, by your rating, that received 23 5-star ratings in iTunes. So tell us about this and what people should look for and how they should figure these things out.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you spotted that. You guys are getting this before anyone else. We spotted this app by Hasbro, and so whenever we see sort of a big name in Plato and all that, we really want to review it. And it was really a poor design, strikingly poor. And so I was checking the facts, and I noticed it had all these 5-star ratings. And of course, I'm like, I'm a reviewer. I said, we want to make sure I'm right about this. What's going on? And then I noticed all the ratings were all pure 5-stars, and all the descriptions were only 2 sentences each. And they were all like, you know, great app, change my child's life, and all these things. I'm like, okay, something's going on. And so I started looking at the profiles, and I think everyone should do that. There are companies out there, it turns out, that will approach an app developer. This is what I suspect in this case. It wasn't Hasbro or anything like that, but I think it was one of these PR firms. But they will write reviews for you for hire. And so my rule of thumb is, if it has sort of suspicious, just look at the app reviews and you can kind of see the fake ones.
I want to take a quick call from Judy in Bexley. Hi, Judy, are you on there?
Yes. I have an issue with two-dimensional play. It is not developmentally appropriate. Kids need to learn to manipulate 3D objects, picking up the little pieces, going crawling around, finding the block.
Yeah, but we're talking about traveling in a car. That's what we're talking about.
Traveling in a car is one isolated thing. He was talking about how it makes you a better vac control person with the hand controls. Well, you've got to have fine trunk controls, lean over. Real vision is in a huge field, and it has depth. It's not on a little screen. And these kids should be getting on a bicycle, going to a friend's house, interacting socially, getting out the little pieces.
Judy, we really do appreciate what you're saying, but we're talking about apps for when people are taking long trips in cars. That's specifically what we're talking about.
At this moment or earlier?
During this whole segment has been about apps for travel with kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize.
No, don't worry about it. Warren, go ahead.
Yeah, Judy, I you're raising a great point, and I would agree with everything you're saying, that kids do need to ride bikes and do real manipulatives. I'm a Piagetian trained developmental psychologist, if that counts for anything. I am an early childhood educator. I really understand how important it is. I think it's important to not take an either or point of view on this, that there are contributions of both, real, and nobody is suggesting here to take away, the real stuff. So, I think.
Are kids getting used to doing things on a screen?
Hmm.
I hope they are, because that's probably going to be how they order submarine sandwiches at the fast food place. And if they can't, they'll starve to death. I'm sort of making light of it. But, I really seriously do think that children need a variety of skills, both on screen and off screen. And the way they develop those skills is through play. And hopefully it's child-controlled play. And so I'm sure we would agree on much more than we disagree on.
Okay, I just had one thing to add about fine dexterity.
Okay.
We're not teaching handwriting in school anymore.
Right.
And that's when you really practice fine control of your hands. So if you're not doing crafts, if you're not doing things with fine manipulatives for play, I don't know who's going to be the dentist and the surgeons and the people who have to really get in there, watch, repair. It, we're not it's a whole skill that we're just kind of letting go to the mouth. And that's I'll take the comment off the air.
All right, Judy. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep. Now, yes, I doodle. I'm a doodler, so that's how I get my fine motor activity. But go ahead, Warren Bucklader.
Yeah, Judy, I'd say check out Letter School. There's it's sort of finger painting, and it is fine motor. There actually are quite a few fine motor kinds of activities on a multi-touch screen. The thing that's interesting about multi-touch, which is what the iPad has, is that it can support 11 simultaneous touches. And so there are actually some very interesting fine motor puzzles that can enhance a child's fine motor development. So, you know, I think that it's important to keep an open mind. Another thing that strikes me is that grown-ups have famously been, over the generations, worried about things. I remember my parents worried a lot about me watching The Three Stooges. And I remember thinking as a kid how absurd it was. They thought I'd really be violent based on the violence I was watching on television. But, you know, here we are again, another generation who's worried about stuff. And I really believe that at the end of the day, the kids will sort of guide us through this. And they will, they'll take the things that support their own learning.
Well, Warren Buckleitner, it's been a delight. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. And I guess I should tell you at the very end that I'm from Michigan. So my wife went to University of Michigan. But I love the Ohio State Marching Band.
Oh, I know. The best damn band in land. And I'm from Michigan, too. I'm a Spartan. So there you go.
Seriously? Oh, yeah. You should have told me up front. So, okay.
Well, all right.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Warren. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yeah, bye.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Classical 101 brings you classical music 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. I'm Boyce Lancaster. Join Jennifer Hambrick, John Rittmeyer, and me on Classical 101. We're on the radio, of course, and we're streaming on the web at wosu.org/classical101. It's Classical 101, classical music all day, every day.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on the Supreme Court term that ended last week with Adam Liptak, the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent. Liptak says Chief Justice Roberts' patient and methodical approach has allowed him to establish a robustly conservative record. We'll also talk about Liptak's new e-book on the Supreme Court and the battle for same-sex marriage. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is a green alternative for used computers. Donating computers makes a positive impact on the environment by keeping toxic e-waste out of landfills. Computers are refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. Donation information at atohio.org.
Enjoy America's favorite Independence Day celebration from Washington, D.C. on a Capitol 4th this Thursday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a successful Kickstarter campaign last year, the tech company Adaptiva is set to release its first batch of credit card-sized, get this, supercomputers. Now comes the big question. What exactly are people going to do with these things? Joining us now to discuss that and other gadget news is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Hi, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Seriously, credit card-sized supercomputers. First, before we get started, define what a supercomputer is.
Okay, so this has a lot to do with the definition of a supercomputer, and that's where it comes into play here. You know, what makes this a supercomputer is how it can be used for you know, multi-core processing and things like that. But as a standalone piece of hardware, this is not, you know, this isn't something that's more powerful than, say, a laptop or a desktop that you would buy off the shelf. It's just more capable of a very specific kind of processing.
Okay. So this new tiny supercomputer is called Parallella, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm always having to check the pronunciations. First off, is it a real... Okay, so what... Does the name have some significance, Parallella?
The idea behind supercomputers is that you can run processes in parallel.
Okay.
The whole point here is that this is an inexpensive way for a very specific kind of computing to be done. You can take these and you can daisy chain them together. They're very simple pieces of hardware. You know, being as small as they are, it's a dual core processor with 1 gig of RAM and very, very simple hardware. But the design here is that these can be, you know, you can put 30 of them together and use them as kind of one cohesive unit. So the idea here is that this is now an inexpensive way to accomplish supercomputer style computing, with a lot of the changes that have been done in how, operating systems handle processor architecture. It's really, really complicated stuff that's not easy to make sound simple and be accurate at the same time. Yeah, I can make it sound really simple, but it would also, be wrong if it's heard. What's cool about this is that it is a fantastically inexpensive way to accomplish this kind of computing. This is something that was on Kickstarter, for people who want to get kind of the first hands on with this. But the idea follows very much in line with the things that we've seen with Raspberry Pi and these similar, the Beagle board from I missed the name of the company now. These microcomputer systems are designed to make, these computing projects. You don't have to rely on giant companies to provide these big expensive systems anymore. You can build one exactly to fit the needs of the task at hand, and that's really significant.
And I think it's interesting, and I do see this step down possibility from having to turn to these giant corporations that have these huge computers. You don't have to. This is something a smaller outfit can manage. But give me an example of what they would, daisy chain these together to do. You can't.
Not without being more complicated. A good idea for this kind of thing would be people who compile software. People who are writing software from kind of the basic layer up,
okay,
would be able to use these to compile software faster, because it would allow them to run the necessary commands in parallel instead of one immediately after the other.
Okay.
So that would be really the biggest example. It's a great way of processing a significant amount of data very fast instead of having to process it in line, if
okay.
that makes any sense
it
at all.
It does make sense. I get it. Kind of. One more explanation. Someone said that it can achieve 90 gigaflops, and I'm like, what? I don't even, what's a gigaflop?
Yes, I didn't try and go that route for explaining because those are metrics that a lot of people just aren't going to understand.
But okay.
It's allowed to process a lot of information very fast. So when you think about, things like the SETI Institute, where they mm-hmm. have these massive pictures of space and they're processing all of the data that comes along with that. And as we're doing things like mapping the cosmos or mapping underwater sea levels and things like that, we're taking huge amounts of data and trying to process it and make it user readable. And supercomputers and supercomputer processing is what makes that, happen at a speed that is, acceptable.
And of course, we haven't mentioned yet the price, which is what makes all of this, possible.
Yeah, each one of these is $100.
Yeah.
Which is really, they have more expensive versions depending on how many cores you want on your processor. They can go up to be about $750. But for just the base model, it's $100. And again, that's what sets it up very much like Raspberry Pi and these similar Arduino boards. Mm-hmm. This is just a much more powerful version of that concept.
Let's talk about hard drive data recovery, which affects a lot more people than maybe for now the supercomputers will.
No, I think that a lot of people misunderstand. This was something I had a conversation with a guy who ran a data recovery company recently. And one of the things that he explained to me that made a ton of sense once he said it out loud was a lot of people misunderstand the purpose of performing a backup on your system. And a lot of people say you need to back up your data, you need to, you know, you need to back up your files and things. And what is commonly taken from that is I need a hard drive, I need an external hard drive that's plugged in somewhere, and I'll take all my files and move it to that hard drive, and that's where my backup lives. But that's not really a backup. That's moving files from one place to another. There's still something that could happen to that drive. And if something happens to that drive, then you've lost everything that you've backed up. So, you know, the one of the things I wanted to talk about today was, you know, kind of better explaining that the concept behind backup is redundancy. It's not having all of your files in one place. It's having all of your files in more than one place.
Okay.
To accomplish that backup. So we have a lot of really cool online services right now that do a ton of backup. I mean, we've got Dropbox and Google Drive and a lot of these things that are very good at backing up files, but it's also just one place. And if anything were to happen to those services, you know, while they have redundancies of their own, there's still a significant risk of data loss, you know, for you as a user.
Okay.
So a lot of times what gets recommended is that you have, you know, a hard drive at home that you only, you know, that you don't keep running, that you plug in when you go to do a backup, or that you have connected to a network device. The Apple is fantastic with the Time Capsule service because they have a hard drive built into their networking device that will perform backups and does nothing else. It doesn't get used for anything other than grabbing a backup and storing it. And then you can take that and also store those things either online or on a separate drive, so that if anything happens to you know, one hard drive, then you have another that's kind of acting as you know, the backup of the backup. So that was, you know, one of the things, because I talked to this gentleman from Flashback Data Recovery for a while last week.
This is a data recovery specialist.
Yes. Okay. And he walked me through the process of actually recovering a hard drive and recovering data from a smartphone. And it's really, you know, fantastic stuff, the way that they take all this stuff apart and go to repair everything. But, you know, one of the things that he told me as he was talking to me was that the most common thing that he, you know, ends up having to do is someone who brings him a hard drive and says, you know, I put all of my pictures and all of my, you know, personal stuff on here because this was my backup drive and it's gone. And now I have nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's really, you know, kind of an unfortunate situation to be in. And data recovery, you know, as nice as this gentleman was, data recovery is not not an inexpensive thing, especially if the drive is physically damaged. They go through a lot to try and replace each individual part to try and get the drive to run again, so that they can grab the information off of the drive. You know, so I wanted to talk about that a little bit. And I think, you know, in the next couple of weeks, I will come up with some drives that are good alternative, like good things to purchase for the home.
Okay.
You know, for people who are interested or, you know, are looking for either a first drive or a second drive for backup. To try and, you know, offer that as alternatives.
I wanted to talk about what they do when they do recover data. You said it's expensive. It's not the sort. It's the thing corporations do if they lose data. It's not the thing that Joe Blow gets to do because it's so expensive. They use clean rooms where they open up the hard drives. What are those? Why are they needed?
Yeah, so they're either clean rooms or as this gentleman used, you know, individual you know, boxes that are clean. And the idea is that they have, you know, multiple filters to filter air as it comes in, so that there are no there are very, very few particles in the air, and everything is, you know, is as sterile as possible because, you know, the way hard drives are made, you know, if anything, you know, messes with the plates on the inside, if anything gets, you know, in between the plates on the inside, or if the plates are shifted even a little bit, you know, your data's gone. There's very little that can be done at that stage to repair it. However, you know, connecting all of those plates and, you know, the things that are responsible for writing information to all those plates can be fragile. And they can be repaired, you know, they can be replaced or they can be rewired. And in those cases, the information on those plates on the inside of that drive become accessible again. And so that's what these clean rooms are for. They're for very carefully taking, you know, each piece of plastic and silicone off of these drives so as not to, you know, damage the plates in any way or not let anything get in the way of these plates, but also, you know, make it so that you can, you know, get the drive up and running again so that you can plug it into a computer and get the data.
Okay, I wanted to talk real quick about the HTC One Google Play Edition. We've talked about the HTC One before. You recently reviewed the Google Play Edition of this phone. What's the diff? Why is Google releasing these? What's the diff?
So Google's doing two of these. They're doing one for the HTC One and one for the Samsung Galaxy S4. And these are running, you know, kind of Google's flavor of Android. And this gets a little complicated to explain, but so Google releases Android, and companies will take Android and kind of modify it to suit their needs. You know, they will add features and make things look a little differently because it's kind of their, you know, their version of Android. And a lot of companies do this so much that, you know, Google, you know, has their own brand of phones, the Nexus phones, that are running the software, but there's not a whole lot of other people that are running Google's version, despite a lot of companies, a lot of people really wishing that, that they would. And so this is kind of a collaboration between Google and HTC and Google and Samsung to release a phone that has, you know, all the really nice hardware parts of the HTC One and the Galaxy S4, but running software that is much closer to what you would see on a Nexus.
Okay, it's not necessarily faster.
No, so it's definitely, in my test, I didn't see that it was any faster. It's definitely a cleaner user experience.
Okay.
You know, it looks, you know, very plain. You're not going to see any software that HTC has partnered with other people to kind of get you to use, which is the case with a lot of Android phones. Sometimes, you know, it'll come with other stuff that they're going to try and suggest that you use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of that is on there. And you know, the user interface will receive updates. The idea is that they will receive updates much faster because, you know, Google is releasing the update and HTC or Samsung doesn't have to do a whole lot in order to get that update.
The visual experience is a big difference. How?
Google's kind of vision for Android is, you know, kind of very simple, very, you know, straight lines and simple colors. And HTC and Samsung, you know, kind of like to splash it up a little bit. And there's a lot of, you know, heavy animations and things like that. So it's the visual experience here is very much what you would see if you've ever used a Nexus phone or tablet, you know, where the color palettes are, you know, very flat and, you know, visually it's really nice. There's not a lot of bright colors, you know, so it's really a personal preference, but it's a very clean experience compared to what can often be, you know, kind of cluttered feeling. From HTC and Samsung.
And real quick, which works best with the camera?
I definitely think that HTC's, you know, in the case of the HTC One, I haven't tested the Galaxy S4 yet, but in the case of the HTC One, the one that's released by HTC, the one with the Sense software on it, in my opinion, produces better photos. It's just, you know, cleaner colors, less distortion. It's not a huge difference, but if you take the photos and set them side by side, if you're taking the exact same thing, then, you know, you will notice that the Google Play edition of the HTC One isn't quite as nice as the regular HTC One.
Russell Holley, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening all day today. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.